Okay, so the next sutra here is called the Diga Jhana Sutra. So now we're going to move on into this area we're just talking about how to deal with the mind, all these factors we were looking at before, the kinds of right conduct, sense restraint, clear comprehension and careful attention, all of these things. So this is about how to deal with the mind, but I'm going to start off with a sutta which deals a little bit more with morality more generally, and then we're going to get to those suttas that deal more directly with mental training later on. So this is what this first sutta is about. It is a sutta which is a bit unusual. Sometimes I read these things and I think, oh, that's interesting, so I just kind of take it out. It's not just because sometimes you need to do something slightly different, see things from a slightly different angle, because sometimes that adds a little bit to the perspective of what this whole training in morality or whatever else, what it is all about. So let's have a look at this sutta and see what comes out of it. So the Diga Jhana Sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya 8. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Kaulians, where there was a market town of the Kaulians named Kakkarapatta. Then the Kaulian family man Diga Jhana approached the Blessed One, paying homage to him, and sat down to one side. So seated, he said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, we are lay people who enjoy sensual pleasures, dwelling at home in a bed crowded with children, enjoying fine sandalwood, wearing garlands, scents and unguents, accepting gold and silver. Let the Blessed One teach Dhamma to us in a way that will lead to our welfare and happiness, both in the present life and in the future life as well." So this is a kind of standard way of people who kind of live the ordinary life in a kind of ordinary way, perhaps a little bit of extra luxury here. And so this is standard. This idea of dwelling in a home crowded with children is one of those phrases that you see in the sutta. It seems to have been just an idiom for living in a crowded life, basically. And enjoying all this sandalwood and all the kind of thing, that's kind of, those are the luxuries of that time. Okay, so there are Byagapajja, these four things that lead to the welfare and happiness of a family man in this very life. What for? The accomplishment of persistent effort, the accomplishment of protection, good friendship, and balanced living here. So these are one of the interesting things about these things. They are kind of very practical and fairly ordinary things. And it's amazing the kind of areas where the Buddha gives instruction is actually quite broad when you start to see this. These are the sort of obvious things that you would perhaps never think the Buddha was on about, because you think he talked about more profound and deep things. But he actually gave advice on a very broad range of things, even the most ordinary, obvious things that everybody should really know about to some extent. So these are this is the first one. So let's see what the Buddha has to say. Usually the Buddha has an interesting way of talking about even these basic matters, so it's still interesting here. And what is the accomplishment of persistent effort? Here, Byagapajja, whatever may be the means by which a man earns his living, whether by farming, trade, cattle raising, archery, or civil service, or by some other craft, he is skillful and diligent. He investigates the appropriate means, and he is able to act and arrange everything properly. This is called accomplishment of persistent effort. Right? So this is kind of, it makes it very obvious in many ways, right? The first thing, of course, here is that he talks about a family man. Very often these suttas are phrased from a male point of view, and many reasons for that, but one reason obviously that in those days there was more, a man would normally be in charge of a household, which it probably is true in many ways even today in India, but that was kind of the way it was. It tends to be phrased in that way. But of course it's true for everybody, right? By whatever means he makes his living, you get a nice sequence of different trades there, different types of occupation. You can see what people were doing in those days. So that gives you some idea. So whatever you do in life, you make sure that you are skillful and diligent, right? When you are skillful and diligent, you investigate the appropriate means. The word for means here is upaya. And this word upaya becomes much more important in later Buddhism. It becomes to mean the skillful means that is used by a teacher, for example, in teaching his disciples. And in later Mahayana Buddhism becomes a very important term, this idea. But here in the early suttas, it just means, you know, investigate, and you investigate what is the appropriate way or a good way to approach a matter, to make sure you do the job well, right? Skillfully to do the job well, and you're able to act and arrange everything properly. So it's just a way of showing you how you know, make the most out of your job, how you do a good job, and how you get some sort of rewards from that job. That's really all the Buddha is saying. You investigate, you work hard, you do things properly, and then the job, whatever work you do, will usually have good results. You usually get the job done, whatever it is. That's really all he's saying there. Very obvious, perhaps, but not everybody even gets such basic things. And what is the accomplishment of protection? Here, Byagapadra, a family man, sets up protection and guard over the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arm, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. Thinking, how can I prevent kings and bandits from taking this away? Fire from burning it, floods from sweeping it off, and unloved heirs from taking it. This is called accomplishment of protection. And the first thing which is interesting here is this idea of the wealth that is righteously earned, right? That you have earned by working hard and you have built up kind of money for yourself, maybe to take into retirement. In those days they didn't have any retirement funds, right? You either looked after yourself or nobody really looked after you. I guess that's why children were considered so important in those days, because they would help you out in your old age perhaps. But the interesting thing here, this idea of righteously gained wealth, it seems to be, and I think it is very reasonable, that the only wealth that was really considered worth having here was the wealth that was righteously gained. If you have earned the money for yourself, you have worked hard, you know it is honest, it's an honest day's work, right? It's not, you haven't cheated anybody and all that kind of thing, then it feels much better to use that money for yourself. You use it on your family, you use it in a good way, and it feels like you really have earned the usage of that money. Whereas money, if it is badly gained money, then you probably don't feel so happy by using it either. You don't get the same pleasure out of it. That's kind of also another very interesting thing, right? There's much more pleasure to be gotten out of righteous gain than unrighteous things. And there's another place in the sutras as well where it talks about giving, the act of generosity. And it says the same thing. It says that you give from the money that you have gained in a righteous way, in a good way, through an honest day's work, by your own hard work and sweat and labor. That is the money those are the possessions, that's the money or the wealth you give away to others. And that's when it feels like real giving, right? This is really yours, it really belongs to you. You've earned it in the right way and now you're giving it away. And that is when the joy becomes much more powerful. If you have stolen some money and you give it away, it doesn't really feel like it's yours in the first place, right? And you don't get the same happiness and joy after giving if it isn't righteously gained in that way. So this is very kind of an important point, that, you know, what is the kind of wealth that is really worth having in this world? Of course, if you have inherited the wealth, the money, that's of course, it will be the same thing. That will be fine. That's not a problem. It's kind of righteously gained, I suppose. Good karma or whatever you call it, but it's righteous in a certain way. So an interesting little point, that actually you get much more happiness when things have been acquired in a good way rather than by cheating or defrauding or whatever else it might be. And then this lovely little phrase, right? You were all laughing when you heard that. How can I prevent kings and bandits from taking this away? And I think in those days, kings were pretty more random, perhaps, than the authorities are these days. It was, okay, I haven't got enough money in my my coffers or whatever, so I need to kind of supply a bit more, so we'll just raise the taxes for a while, and kind of, or whatever, I don't know what they did, but obviously kings were probably a bit more active than perhaps authorities are these days. So basically, you put up, you are wise about how you deal with your money, right? You put it in a way where it isn't kind of easily swept away by floods and all these kind of things. And you are wise about looking after it in a proper way. So you look after things. You're not stupid. And sometimes people say, oh, it's bad karma, you know, it was stolen from me or whatever. But sometimes it isn't bad karma. Sometimes you just haven't done the right thing, look after it in a proper way. So you never really tempt fate, right, to tempt karma to ripen at the wrong time or something like that. You try to stop karma from ripening here. So you say, okay, I'm going to protect it in the right way here. Don't think that your karma will protect you from everything here. If you're silly, then the silliness is going to be what decides the outcome, not the karma. Okay, and then we have good friendship, right? Kalyanamitta that we have talked about before here. And here, Vyagapanja, in whatever village or town a family man dwells, he associates with householders or their sons, whether young or old, who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, in morality, in generosity, and in wisdom. He converses with them and engages in discussion with them. He emulates them in regard to their accomplishment in faith, morality, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. Right, so sometimes whoever has these qualities, these are the people you hang out with. These are your people, you make your friends, and you learn from them, and you emulate them. And of course, this is one of the good things in the present day about having places like the Buddhist Society, or you know, places where you can meet like-minded people, or people who have even gone further on the path than you, right? So you can kind of look at them and ask, well, you know, how can I do to also move in the right direction? And this is a similar kind of thing here. You have all these people that have gone there before you. And these are the kind of standard qualities that you look for in somebody who is a good friend, right? You are virtuous. You have faith in the right thing or confidence in the right area. You have morality. Generosity, and you have wisdom. So you have this. These are kind of the standard four qualities of somebody who's considered a good friend. So could we talk a little bit more about these qualities in a second, because they come up again in the next paragraph as we move along here. And of course, the point here is that you socialize with these people, you converse with them, you get discussion with them, so that your understanding of these issues, they actually increase. And what is balanced living? Here, Vyagapajja, a family man, knows his income and expenditures and leads a balanced life, neither extravagant nor miserly, so that his income exceeds his expenditures rather than the reverse. Just as a goldsmith or his apprentice holding up scales knows by so much it has dipped down and by so much it has lifted up, so a man leads a balanced life. So again, pretty obvious advice, right? You lead a balanced life. There is another nice sutta which talks about how to live a good life in a balanced way, even how to spend your money wisely. The Sigalovada Sutta, but a well-known sutta, and it's found in the Digha Nikaya number 32, the advice to Sigala. And that gives a large amount of advice on how to live a good life, specifically meant for lay people. So it goes into all kind of, you know, relationships between people and all these kind of things. And it's a nice one. Sometimes it's called like the lay vinaya, the lay training is sometimes called that particular sutta. Digha Nikaya 32, the long discourses of the Buddha. And there he talks about, you know, how to make sure that you put aside, you have the money, enough money for looking after yourself. And one of the beautiful little phrases in there, which isn't mentioned here, but which is mentioned there and also other places in the Anguttara Nikaya, you use your wealth, you use your money to make yourself happy, right? This is the first one. You use it for, this is kind of the reason why we have wealth in the first place. You use it to make yourself happy. Yourself, you are first on the list, right? If you have made the money, then you have the right to use it to make yourself happy. Then you use it to make your wife and children happy, or maybe your husband and children happy, depending on the situation, right? So use it for that. Then you use it for making your parents and other relations happy. I think parents are separated out because parents are always regarded in a special way. And then the other relations, then all the people who work for you, right? Whoever that might be. And then... So all of these things, you actually make people happy with this wealth. You use it in a good way here. And that's such a pragmatic and obvious way that we should use money or use our possessions in such a way here. And then having done that, it also says that you set some of your money aside, right, for in case of trouble or difficulties, maybe for when you become a pensioner or if there is illness or whatever else, you set some of the money aside. Use some of the money you have to obviously pay in taxes, so that goes to the king or whatever. And then also it says use certain money for like acts of charity. And specifically in those days, the most obvious act of charity was to give to ascetics and Brahmins. But charitable activities in general, also a certain amount for that. So you have a kind of balanced lifestyle. That's what it talks about there. So the Buddha is very kind of it's all very pragmatic and very obvious, but sometimes we need to be reminded of the obvious things, because sometimes the mind does weird stuff and it gets kind of dragged down the wrong way. So anyway, there you are. So then we have four ways, sources of dissipation. Okay, so you make all this money, but then the money starts to dissipate, right? And these are the sources of dissipation. The wealth thus amassed has four sources of dissipation. Womanizing, drunkenness, gambling, and evil friendship or bad friendship. Just as in the case of a tank with four inlets and outlets, if one should close the inlets and open the outlets, and there would not be adequate rainfall, a decrease rather than an increase of the water could be expected in the tank. So these four things bring about dissipation of amassed wealth. Right? So all of these things are kind of intoxicating things, things that intoxicate you, that bring you out of balance. You don't really know what you are doing anymore. Right, you're kind of just pursuing all these kind of pleasures, or so-called pleasures. They're not really perhaps proper pleasures anyway, but you're pursuing all of these things. And because they are intoxicating, you lose your way, right? Drunkenness and gambling are kind of classic examples of being intoxicated and losing your way, and being addicted to things. And so because of that, you don't know what's going on anymore. And things just tend to get worse and worse and worse as a consequence. We all know what can happen with gambling addiction and alcohol addiction. It can be very bad, have very bad consequences. And bad friendship is the same. Bad friendship takes you down the garden path. They leads you up the garden path. There's all kind of problems happen because of that. And again, it's the opposite of a good friendship that we're talking about just before. So it's very problematic. And I remember a few years ago it was an interesting debate. I'm sure you've had this debate here in Perth as well. I think the casino here in Perth was established back in the 1980s or something. And if I don't really know, but that was before I came to Australia. But I think I've seen, even now, you see occasionally references to that. And there was a big public debate whether you should have a casino in Perth or not, and whether it's going to lead to all kind of problems. And a few years ago, they had a similar kind of debate in Singapore. I remember I was in Singapore at the time, and they were arguing. I mean, in Singapore, they built two really large casinos now, but the debate was raging, should we have casinos or not? Is it going to lead to kind of the downfall of society in Singapore if we have casinos? And this is interesting, right? How far should these things be? You know, as Buddhists, okay, gambling is bad, right? Should it be legalized again? Should we have laws against this? Or is it more of a private matter that we should do? This is always one of those questions that we come across. And at that time, that was a question in the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. What should we do? Should we go against this? Should we say it's okay? What is like the Buddhist position on these things? I think the Buddhist position is, first of all, there isn't really any absolute position on these things, but the Buddhist position that these things are, first and foremost, they are matters of private morality. It is I have to decide for myself how I want to live my life, right? Am I going to live it according to the five precepts or not? Am I going to live it according to common sense or not? And it's not necessary, from a Buddhist point of view, to necessarily outlaw all these things. You can't outlaw all immorality anyway. There are limits to what you can outlaw. Like alcohol, for example, they tried to outlaw that in the past. There was a prohibition era in a number of countries, and And it just didn't really work. People started making alcohol, you know, privately at home, and it was of bad quality, and people died, and all this kind of stuff happened as a consequence. So there's always that question between private morality. Does it need to be legalized? Should it be laws against them? Or is it a personal matter? And the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, they eventually decided, well, this actually is probably not necessarily something the government has to control. And anyway, there was all the gambling coming up online and all this kind of stuff anyway. But it was more of a matter of personal ethics and morality rather than what needs to be legislated against. And that is interesting. I think that if morality really is going to be powerful, if morality is going to have a power, at least personally in your life, then it has to come from inside of you. You have to say, I want to be moral. I want to do the right thing, right? And when it comes from inside of you, rather than it is imposed from the outside, then it becomes a very powerful force in your own spiritual life. It's a bit like meditation practice. If you meditate on your own free will, then it becomes very, very, very powerful. But if you meditate just because, okay, now we come together as a group and you have to meditate or whatever, it is not as powerful as it is when you do it on your own free will. And then that's when you really investigate and you really understand what is happening. So ideally, all of these things, they come from inside of us. We want to do them. Then they are really powerful. And I don't really have any particular opinion whether it should be legislated against or not. I think it's kind of very hard to say sometimes. But that's not the main issue from a Buddhist point of view. Okay, anyway. So let us move on. Similarly, there are four sources of increase of amassed wealth. Abstinence from womanizing, from drunkenness, from gambling, and from bad friendship. Just as in the case of a tank with four inlets and outlets, if one should open the inlets and close the outlets, and there would be adequate rainfall, an increase rather than a decrease of the water could be expected in the tank. So these four things bring about the increase of amassed wealth. These four things, Bhagapaja, lead to a family man's wealth and happiness in the present life. So there you are. So it looks almost like the standard things of Buddhism are not even mentioned in here, right? What about morality, etc.? It is just mentioned almost in passing as those things that you should do. You should emulate those people who are of good moral conduct in society. That's almost all that is said in there. But lots of other practical advice is in there instead. So then we come to the morality, those things that lead to happiness in the future lives. Four other things lead to a family man's wealth and happiness in the future life. What for? Accomplishment in faith, in morality, in generosity, and in wisdom. So these things are mostly to do with the future life, which is interesting, right? These things obviously affect us in the present life as well, whether you know how you feel psychologically and all these kind of things. But as for the future life, they become obviously really, really important, because then it has to do with rebirth and all of such things. So that is when it is particularly interesting here. And how is a family man accomplished in faith? Here, Bhagapaja, a family man has faith. He places faith in the awakening of the Tathagata. So the Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly awakened, accomplished in true insight and conduct, sublime knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teachers of devas and humans, the Awakened One, the Blessed One. In this way, a family man is accomplished in faith. Right? You have, when you see somebody who is awakened, when you see a person who is awakened, when you see a Buddha, right? Then you are able to discern that. You're able to see that. You're able to see that here there is something special. And when you see that, you place faith and confidence in that person. And this is what this really is all about. And of course, that is sometimes difficult. Sometimes you don't have the faculties to discern these things. Sometimes you're not able to see where who is really worthy of your faith and confidence. But this is the right way of doing things. So let's have a quick look at all of these words here that are mentioned here. this formula that you see here is the standard formula that you chant when we chant the homage to the Triple Gem, right? The Iti Piso Bhagava Arahan Samma Sambuddho Vidya Charana Sampanno, etc. This is the one. So this is the standard way of recollecting the Buddha in according to the suttas, according to the Buddha himself. The Buddha says, if you want to recollect me, this is how you should do it. So you are focusing on the qualities of the Buddha, right? It's not really personality worship so much. It is really what focusing on these qualities of this person. Because once you understand the qualities, you start to understand why the Buddha is so important, why he matters so much. We'll see that in a second, why that is the case. And it's fairly obvious, really. So the Blessed One is the Arahant. The Arahant is like somebody who is perfected. Perfected in the sense of not having any more defilements, right? You are as perfected as it is possible to become as a human being. But the real meaning of the word Arahant actually means somebody who is worthy, right? A worthy person. So it's like, what worthy of what? And of course, one of the first things that they are worthy of is like they're worthy of our support, right? Our support in terms of material support and generosity. They're worthy of our kind of respect, right? Worthy of our hospitality. They're worthy like somebody who is special. It is fairly obvious in a sense. Why is it? Why are people worthy of kindness? Why are they worthy of generosity? And one kind of person who is worthy of respect is always a teacher figure, right? A teacher, what does a teacher do? A teacher imparts on us some kind of knowledge that we didn't have before. And that's why a teacher is so important. You go to school, or your parents are your teacher, and they help you out. They teach you things that will be useful in your life, to make your life possible, to give you happiness, to be able to make enough money, right? Able to look after your bank account and all of these kind of things. And parents are kind of some of the most important teachers that we have, because they teach us some of the most basic things in life that we need to know. Without our parents, we wouldn't know very much at all. We'd be pretty completely ignorant, even of the most basic things. So parents are called the Pubhacharya in the suttas. Pubha means like the first or the past. They are the first teachers. Acharya is teacher. So they are the Pubhacharya, the first teachers in our life. And this is one of the reasons that parents are considered in the Buddhist teaching to be so worthy of respect and worthy of hospitality, because they have given us so much. Even, of course, sometimes people say, "Oh, but I had a very difficult upbringing." That's true, and of course that makes it more difficult. But even in those cases, parents have actually taught us a lot, even though sometimes the relationship also have had some detrimental sides. For that reason, parents are considered worthy of all of these things, and they're almost placed on the same level as the Arahats in the suttas, placed very, very highly in terms of being worthy of hospitality. So this is why teachers are considered worthy of kindness, respect, all of these things, because they give us something we haven't got. Without them, it wouldn't be the same, right? So they are giving to us. Well, surely they deserve to get something back. And of course, the point here is that the Buddha, he has the highest of all gifts. There is no gift you can get that is more than being able to live your life in such a way that it ends possibly all suffering and you achieve the highest possible happiness. And even if you don't achieve the highest happiness, at least you achieve some of it. You're going in the right direction. The Buddha is able to give us that thing which everybody wants, right? We all want this. We all want a reduction in problems and an increase in well-being, contentment, happiness, all of these things. And of course, if you have the highest gift to somebody else, you are worthy of respect. You're worthy of offering. You are, and this is what this, in part, what this Arahant word actually means. So this would be a right way of thinking of the Buddha, right? Well, he's freely giving us the highest gift, and then you can imagine yourself what we can do in return. Okay, so he is the Arahant. He is the perfectly awakened one, right? Samma, Sambuddho is the Pali word here. And perfectly awakened to what? Perfectly awakened to the truth. Right, perfectly awakened to reality. So it's not. It is something which is kind of it goes together with the, you know, I mean, one way of approaching reality is kind of modern scientific research. We're trying to find out the truth about things. And this is like a more personal way of searching for the truth of reality of things, going inside of yourself and searching for the truth there instead. They're kind of two slightly different ways of trying to find truth in the world. But they should kind of somehow work together. So a Buddha is perfectly awakened. He has found the highest truth that can be found through that sort of personal search inside. And of course, finding that sort of truth inside, it is great, right? Sometimes you think, oh, maybe that truth isn't worth knowing. Maybe it's no good. And maybe it's when I get there, I think, oh no, I wish I hadn't found out about this. And sometimes when you read the suttas, it may sound like that. So I know that some of you who have come to the retreats for the first time, one of you told me, oh, this is a bit too much. I'm not sure how to deal with this. I'll take the good things about Buddhism. This, I'll just put that aside for now. That's actually is a good way of thinking about it. This is actually the right way here. Don't just dismiss it straight away at the very least, but put it aside for now because it just is too much. That's perfectly. You have to do that basically. It would be crazy to force these things onto yourself if you're not ready for them. But the Buddha, basically, the idea here, he has awakened to the truth. And remember that when you awake to the truth, it's always a good thing to see the truth. It's never a bad thing here. When you come to the truth, it's not, oh no, I wish I didn't see this. Ignorance is bliss kind of idea. It doesn't work. And why not? Because only when you know the truth can you make good decisions about living how your life. If you are blinded by ignorance, if you don't see things as they actually are, if you think that A is B and up is down and black is white, right? If you're deluded about things, you will always make the wrong decisions because you're making decisions based on blindness and not seeing what is there. It's like, you know, you want to drive back to Perth or wherever you live after the retreat and you are deluded, so you take the road to Albany instead and you end up in Albany. That's not going to be very useful, right? You've got things to do at home. You want to get on with your whatever, maybe go back and do some meditation or whatever. But you don't really want to end up in Albany. So that causes you suffering. And this is wrong information, wrong understanding, always causes problems because you end up making the wrong decisions as a consequence. And here is the same thing. If you don't know the truth, you may think, yeah, being evil, that's really good. That means I can kind of make lots of kind of, you know, I can make all kind of money on the kind of in a kind of dodgy way, and I would be happy with all that money, and et cetera, et cetera. You have the wrong idea of how the world works and how the mind works. And for that reason, you make all kind of stupid decisions. So seeing things according to reality is a great thing. It's a wonderful thing. This is what we mean by wisdom, right? And then you can start making the right decisions in your life, decisions that lead to your own happiness and also the happiness of other people. So wisdom is always good. And here is the one who is accomplished in that wisdom, understanding the mind, understanding our experience to the very depth, as far as it possibly goes. And with that, of course, comes all these other wonderful qualities, the ending of all the defilements, all these things that give us problems, etc., etc. Okay, the next factor here, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, vidya, chadana sampanno. This is like just another way of looking at this idea of perfect awakening. True knowledge, vidya, is the Pali word. It means basically, like, I think it's probably better to call it just insight. True knowledge is a bit, I'm not sure exactly, I guess that's okay as well, but insight is certainly also a good translation. Insight into reality, seeing reality for what it actually is like. The word vidya is also related to the English word wit, and the German word wissen, etc. It's all part of the same word, the same root. And the vidyas, according to the suttas, are usually threefold, the vidyas. And the first one is the knowledge of your past lives, right? This is one of these true knowledges, the real insights in Buddhism. Seeing your past lives. Until then, you think, yeah, maybe there's past lives, I don't know, I'm sure, or maybe you cannot dismiss it. And then one day, wow, you see it for yourself. And then it really drives home the point, right? You see something, you one thing is kind of having faith in these things. Another thing is seeing it with your own eyes. And that's why I mentioned the other day the simile of the little chick breaking out of the shell, right? One day using his little claws and his little beak, kind of getting out of the egg, and then suddenly seeing the world for what it actually is. Until then, the world has been confined inside an eggshell. And then one day you come out of the eggshell. Whoa, this is what the world is like. And that is the same idea here. You see this. It's like coming out of that eggshell. Instead of seeing this tiny sliver of time, which is our life here, the time opens up, right, almost infinitely. Well, not infinitely, but kind of indefinitely into the past. And potentially also indefinitely into the future. Whoa, this is what it's like. It is so different from what I had thought. And of course, once you see it, that's when that reality gets driven home emotionally. Thinking about it, okay, you get a little bit out of it, but actually seeing it, you really feel what it feels like to go on living like this. And that's why it becomes a very, very powerful emotional experience, and which then makes full awakening possible as a consequence. So these are real insights, right? If you want to talk about real insights, this is kind of the stuff which you understand dukkha, you understand what suffering really means, and happiness as well, because these are just flip sides of the same coin. You understand what these things really mean. And of course, the second one is then you understand the law of karma, right? The laws of karma is the second one of these insights, and it's understanding the mechanism that drives rebirth. How does it actually function? And it's actually quite beautifully described in a number of suttas how it's functioned with nice similes and all of that. I'm not going to get into that now, but basically you see how bad conduct drags you down, how good conduct lifts you up, and how this determines this cycle of revolving around in samsara, going from life to life. This law, this impersonal law of karma is what drives you. And please don't make the mistake to think, yeah, sometimes, you know, I used to think like this a little bit. Oh, yeah, it means that I can take charge, right? If it is about karma, I just make sure I make good karma, then I will be reborn in a good place. So no worries. It's actually good that there is a law here, because then I can, you know, I can kind of manipulate that law in my way and kind of be in charge of samsara, right? This is what we all want to be. We want to be in charge of things. We want to control things. The inner controller comes out wherever there's an opportunity and it kind of wants to take over. But it doesn't work like that, because this is what one of the things you see when you see this law. It's an impersonal law, and whether you do good karma and bad karma actually has very little to do with yourself. It has to do with the circumstances you have been in, the kind of friends you have had, and all these kind of things. These are the things that ultimately decide what kind of karma you make. So it is very impersonal at the end of the day. It's very it is very just this thing going on and on and on. And now you get born there, now you get reborn here. And you are much less in charge than you think you are. So this is again this idea of non-self. You're starting to see the non-self nature of things here. You're starting to see how this is driven by causes and conditions. And the impact you have is actually very minute. Because basically you don't understand, right? You don't know what's going on. So how can you have any clarity about making good karma, etc.? And then the last one, the last of these vijjas, this is the last of the true knowledges, is the destruction of the ending of the asavas. The asavas, these deepest set of defilements in the human beings. And when those last asavas are ended, then you know for yourself, ended is birth. All of this running around in samsara has come to an end as a consequence. And you know that, right? So if you have any doubts about whether you are an arahant or not, if you think, yeah, this retreat has been going very well, maybe I become an arahant. If you have the slightest doubt whether you're an arahant, you are not an arahant. That's simple as that. So, because you know when you get there. So, and this is the thing. Oh, okay, birth has ended. I am finished with this. You actually know that for yourself when that happens. And that is the last of those vijjas. You see the Four Noble Truths to the depths, etc., etc. And one of the interesting things here about this is that this vijja, it always comes together with conduct, right? Vijja, charana. Charana is conduct. So when you have these insights, they affect you, right? Sometimes people think, oh, crazy wisdom, right? So you have all this insight, and afterwards you act like this crazy person, you do all kind of crazy stuff because you are now beyond good and evil. You are beyond all of these things, so nothing really affects you anymore. But it doesn't really work like that. When you have this insight, you are fundamentally altered psychologically. You cannot do bad things anymore, right? Either you're crazy or you're wise. You're not both at the same time. Crazy wisdom is an oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms. It's like black-white, good-bad, or something like that. If you are wise, that wisdom comes out in your conduct. You will be kind. You will be friendly to people. You will have stillness in your mind, peace in your heart. You will have all these good qualities, and you will see that in that person. Right? The defilements are gone. You don't have any anger anymore. You can't really be angry. Yes, you can perhaps be a little bit strong. You can have a strong character. Perhaps even be a little bit fierce, but there won't be anger there. That's absolutely impossible. And that, of course, is important because it means that there is a way by which we can actually see, we can actually look at people and see, well, who is likely to be be the real deal, right? And if we see somebody who seems to be getting angry, well, we have good grounds to be skeptical, good grounds to kind of withhold our judgment. Okay, maybe not in this case. So it is actually very important, this fact that conduct you express your insight through your conduct. It actually comes out. There is no such thing as crazy wisdom. There is only wisdom is wisdom, end of story. And you can tell to some extent through people's conduct. And listen what the Buddha says in the suttas. He says that, you know, one of those delightful suttas which makes Buddhism so different from perhaps many other teachings is what the Buddha says. It's called the Vimamsaka Sutta, the Sutta on Investigation. And the Buddha says, investigate me, right? Investigate me, look at me, see if you see anything in me, any qualities that are based on greed, hatred and delusion. Do you see that in me? Right? And if you don't see it, well, then you can place faith in me because you are not seeing any of those bad qualities. It's a marvelous thing that a teacher, the head of a whole religion, this person who lived 2,500 years ago, he says that to his disciples, to everybody, investigate me. You know, he's not afraid. He knows that if somebody investigates in the right way, they will see the right thing anyway. So there's no problem. And if somebody makes a mistake, well, then it's not such a big deal. So this is important, and we should be doing the same thing, right? Don't be afraid of having opinions about things. Don't be afraid if something doesn't seem quite right to acknowledge that. Don't be one of those people who says, oh no, be careful. If this is an arahant, and if you see something bad, it's your fault, not the person's fault. Please don't think like that. Because if you do, you are just closing your eyes. You're acting from fear instead of acting from intelligence and acting from seeing things as they actually are. It is a very bad habit that we have sometimes in the Buddhist world, this idea that don't say anything bad because it's bad karma. No, it's the other way around. It's not seeing what is there. It's closing your eyes to what is there. That, to me, is what is bad karma, because you're denying reality. And then that is really, really not a very good idea at all. So anybody who has the goods, they will be able to withstand that investigation. They won't get upset. Even if you investigate them, they won't get upset. And if they do get upset, well, you know, it's their problem and not yours. Okay. So there you are. Accomplished in real insight and conduct, right? This is what the Buddha is. Then we have the Buddha is sublime. He is the Sugata. Sugata means the one who has... Sugata means like gone well, gone to a good destination, somebody who has achieved the highest happiness, who has achieved all the good results on the Buddhist path. This is what it means here. It's a difficult term to translate appropriately, but I guess sublime is good enough. This is one of the epithets of the Buddha. He's often called the Sugata, the one who has gone to the good destination. In this life. Sometimes it is used also about going to a good destination in future lives. But here it means gone to a good destination right here in this existence. He is knower of the world. Oops. Okay, so he's knower of the world. So what does that mean? And one way of looking at that, of course, is kind of the standard way. You know the world in the sense that you know beings and the various destinations, and you know how people go there, and you know how these various realms, how they function, you know everything about these realms, right? It's like knowing of the world, or you can maybe look through the telescope in our human realm and understand the universe and the galaxies, that kind of stuff. That might also be considered knowing the world. But really, here, what it means here, I think, and it has a deeper sense than that, because knowing the world really, in the end, as I was saying before, comes back to our personal experience, right? It's the world of personal experience that really matters. And so knowing the world means knowing the limits of personal experience. How far is personal experience possible in a bad way? How far is it possible in a good way? What can we experience in this world? And that's one of the things the Buddha says specifically in the suttas. He has encompassed everything that can be known by the sense spaces. He has understood that, understood its limits, understood how far it goes. Right? So this is really knowing the world, knowing what can be experienced. But even more specific than that, because as I was saying before, when we went through dependent origination, the crucial factor in dependent origination, which kind of everything else revolves around a little bit, is the idea of feeling. By feeling, we mean the feeling tone of experience. Is it happy? Is it suffering? Or is it neutral? Right? Vedana is the Pali word. So what the Buddha has seen, when he knows the world, he has known all the potential happinesses and sufferings in the world. He knows the depth of suffering, how far down we can go. And he knows the highest potential for happiness in the world. And he has seen all of that. So he knows what is possible to achieve through being reborn in a particular state. This is very significant because, of course, because he has seen all of that, only when you see all of those things can you really make a decision about whether it is worthwhile continuing on, right? Should I be reborn? Should I not be reborn? How should I be reborn? Should I get out of this whole problem or not? Once you understand suffering and happiness in its completeness, that is when you can make that kind of decision. And that's, of course, what insight is about. You see all of that, and then you say, okay, I want to move towards the end of existence. That's the only proper conclusion that can come from seeing things in this way here. So this is what it really means at the end of the day, understanding the world. And of course, because the Buddha understands happiness and suffering in its fullest, the whole scale, the whole range of what is possible, and whether it is possible to remain with that happiness or whether you have to then be separated from it again because your karma runs out, all of these kind of things. Once you understand that, you have understood basically what all of us, everybody wants to know. We want to know where there's real happiness. We want to know the limits of these things. We want to know how we can achieve these things. So that insight is one of those important things that make the Buddha a Buddha. He has something that all of us really want. And then he is the unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed. I love this little last one there, to be tamed, right? So are we people? Are we to be tamed or are we not to be tamed? This is the question here. And it is one of those idioms that probably we used at that time. You will be considered tameable or not tameable, right? Tameable person. And if you're not tameable, okay, forget about them. You can't be tamed anyway. This is the tameable one. I'm not sure if it is the ideal translation. Usually when we talk about tamed kind of now, we talk about animals, right? We can tame these animals. Taming people seems a little bit strange, but it kind of gives a flavor to what is going on here. If you are full of desires, full of anger and delusion, you are not really tame. It's like the defilements are in charge, right? And because the defilements are in charge, you do all kind of crazy things which are against your own best interest and against the best interest of other people. So we're a little bit wild. As long as the defilements are in charge, there's like a wildness in us, right? It is called the wilderness in the heart in certain places, one of the translations into English. So taming means abandoning those defilements that make us do stupid things, abandoning those, so that the mind becomes pure and nice, and then we can do all the good things in the world as a consequence. So we take away those things that lead us astray, that make us kind of slightly wild, so to speak. So the supreme person to lead us is the Buddha, because part and parcel of having insight into the truth and seeing things according to reality is also understanding the path that leads to that. It is the same kind of thing. You understand that you have to abandon the defilements of the mind, right? Only then can you have clarity, because the defilements distort your outlook. This is part of what you see, so you have to practice in a way whereby the defilements are eliminated. Then you have the samadhis to strengthen the mind, and then based on that you can have insight. So the Buddha understands that path fully through his own insight. And that is why he becomes the unsurpassed leader, because he understands what these things are about. And this is kind of the wonderful thing about the Buddha. The other aspect here, of course, is that he understands that people want this. He has understood that this one thing that everybody, every being in existence is keen on. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to move away from troubles and difficulties. Everybody wants more contentment and happiness. And he knows he has the key to this, right? Here I am, the Buddha, here he is. And he has the key to all that happiness that everybody else wants. So he sees the world, he sees people suffering unnecessarily. He sees them suffering because they are blind, because they don't know what's going on. And he has the key. So what happens? Compassion arises, right? He sees, and then that he has that compassion, and he has the wisdom, the full understanding. And the two together, when they come together, become this beautiful combination that allows the Buddha to be the most efficient at taming people in the world. He becomes the unsurpassed leader, the unsurpassed physician, the unsurpassed doctor to heal our problems, heal our wounds, and move us towards a state of mental health. That is one reason why he called this unsurpassed leader here. Okay, then we have the next one here. He is a teacher of devas and humans, right? Not only is he a teacher of the human beings, but also of the gods as well. I don't know if you think there are such a thing as devas. Maybe you don't think that, but if there are devas, let's put it that way. If there are devas, then he teaches them as well. So, teacher of gods and humans. And of course, part of the point here is that sometimes you may see this light, a light being. Many people can see light beings sometimes, and sometimes you think, "Whoa, this is amazing! This is astonishing!" And then you take these beings to be some kind of higher reality, maybe God or whatever. But the point here is that the Buddha, of course, even though he is human in many ways, still he has a more profound insight, even if some being looks very marvelous and astonishing. So it's important not to be led astray by mere appearances, but actually look at the depth of understanding. That is part of the point here. So this, in a sense, shows us something about the Buddha, right? The Buddha is this is kind of the difficulty with the Buddha, on the to actually get a real appreciation of this person. Because on the one hand, the Buddha is an ordinary person just like us, and it's important to realize that. It's important not to elevate the Buddha in the wrong way. If you think of the Buddha as a god or something too high, then somehow we lose the connection to the Buddha. But we have a very real connection, because he is human just like us. He had the same problems. It's very interesting. When the Buddha talks about his own life, he talks about exactly the kind of problems that everybody really has. Problems with defilements, right? He had a son. He had a good upbringing when he was young. He had a fairly prosperous and wealthy lifestyle, and all of these kind of things. And he talks about his wrong views and all of this kind of stuff. So in many ways, we can relate directly to the Buddha. And it's important not to elevate him too much, because then the connection is lost. And when the connection is lost, the teachings, especially when he teaches about his own life, they don't not so important anymore, because he is different from us. But once you start to understand the Buddha is just like us, then when he talks about his own life, then you realize he's actually teaching, and we should emulate that. He's saying, this is what I did. You should be doing the same thing. We are the same. And for that reason, you should practice in the same way. So the Buddha, yes, he is obviously special in the sense that he has broken through samsara, but he started off like us, and we all have that potential in the same way as the Buddha. So sometimes, you can visualize the Buddha, and when you visualize the Buddha, sometimes you just visualize this man, right? This man in ancient India sitting at the foot of a tree, very peaceful, very quiet. And when you come into the presence of this person, you also feel very peaceful as a consequence. And when you ask a question, you feel that there is a certain wisdom there, a certain power in this person that is very exceptional. But still, it is a person sitting at the root of a tree, right? There's nothing too kind of astonishing about this person. But of course, if you understand the person's mind, it's a different matter here. So finding this balance is important. How far do we kind of respect the Buddha? And how far, finding this middle way somewhere is actually quite difficult, but I think also quite important. Okay, so he is the awakened one and the blessed one, Buddha Bhagava. In this way, a family man is accomplished in faith. So think about those qualities a little bit. This gives you some insight into the Buddha, who he was and what he is, and all those things that are important about him anyway. Everything else is really quite irrelevant. Okay, let's have a quick look at the last factors here. And how is a family man accomplished in morality? Here, Vyagapaja, a family man abstains from the destruction of life, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, the basis for negligence or heedlessness. In this way, a man is accomplished in morality. Right, so these are obviously the five precepts. There they are, right there, five precepts. I don't see them so often in the suttas, but here you find them. Just to keep in mind that if you really want to make good progress in the spiritual life, the five precepts are the foundation stone, but they are not really enough, right? If you just do that and you don't do anything more, you're going to do well, you're going to be have a lot of happiness from that, but ideally you want to take it further than that, right? And remember that one of the important things here with this morality is that it has a negative side and a positive side. Right? So it is the avoidance of doing the bad. You don't destroy life, but actually you do the opposite. You care for life. You have compassion for people and animals. You look after things. If you have a chance to help somebody, you do that. So it is having compassion is the opposite of this. That's the positive side of the precept. Instead of stealing, you have a generous character. Generosity actually comes as a factor in its own right just afterwards, because it is so important. Sexual misconduct, right? So this is about restraining yourself. I'm not sure what the positive side of this is. I guess the positive side here is abstaining from all kind of wrong kind of seeking your happiness in a higher pleasures, perhaps in meditation, that kind of thing is perhaps the positive side of this. And abstaining from false speech. Remember that our speech often has such incredible impact on the people around us. So by saying words that are kind, that are soothing, words that go to the heart of people, this is actually the way the Buddha talks about this, words that are pleasing to the ear, kanna sukha, happy to the ear, is the Pali term. Things that are pleasing to the vast majority of people. If you do that, you're actually creating a lot of happiness around you, if you're able to talk in that way. We affect each other tremendously. And by remembering that, you can actually do a lot of good in the world. So good speech, right? In the four kinds of speech. I'm not going to go into too much detail, because also we are running a little bit out of time for this one. And it's not really the time to look at these things in detail, I think. Last one, avoiding alcoholic drinks and other intoxicants like recreational drugs and that sort of stuff, because they can often be the basis for being negligent, right? Basis for being heedless, not knowing, starting to do all kind of stupid things. In this way, a family man is accomplished in moral discipline. So this area of morality is very important, a very important foundation for all other practice on the Buddhist path. And then we have generosity. And here we have the standard passage on how generosity is practiced when it's practiced well. How is one accomplished in generosity? Here, Vyagapajja, a family man dwells at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. In this way, a family man is accomplished in generosity. Right? You have this open-hearted feeling. Your heart is open. You just enjoy giving out to people, giving out to animals, giving out to anybody. You get this buzz from doing that. You feel so good about this. And this is very powerful when you come down to sit in meditation. You want to get into that state of mind where you feel this open-heartedness and you just want to give to other people, right? Your heart opens up. Wow, what a wonderful thing it is to be able to give and share. And then that is the kind of mind state that actually enables meditation to happen. Without having that mind state, in fact, if there's any degree of stinginess there, that will actually block you from being able to enter samadhi properly here. So you have to have this. This is part of the kind of training to go in that direction. It's a very beautiful feeling anyway. It's not. It's a very, you know, something very, very positive to move towards. So that is the idea of generosity. And then lastly, how is a family man accomplished in wisdom? Here, Vyagapajja, a family man possesses the wisdom that sees into the arising and passing away of phenomena that is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. In this way, a family man is accomplished in wisdom. And here we are starting to get into the deeper aspects of things. This particular thing here means that you have a deep insight into reality here, right? So here, this means that you have understood the arising and passing away means that you understand the laws of impermanence of things coming into existence and passing away here. You have seen this in a deep way so that you have wisdom about these things. And this person here seems to be, the reference here seems to be to somebody who was perhaps a stream enterer, or at least on the path to becoming a stream enterer. So you're very close to stream entry. So here you're talking about a very deep level of insight. And interestingly here, right, there's nothing really here about meditation practice at all. It seems to be all here. It seems to be kind of based on the fact that you live a moral and generous life. And then at the right time, perhaps when you hear a deep discourse on the Dhamma or something like that, you gain some kind of insight as a consequence, perhaps. Or it is just something to be moved towards, something that you want to accomplish. But for the vast majority of ordinary people, it will not be, you know, it's very, very hard to get to that particular point. Anyway, so what you're seeing here, you're seeing a progressive teaching, right? If you look at those qualities there, you start off with faith in the Buddha, then you undertake the precepts, then you gain this profound sense of generosity. And this generosity, as it is described here, is very close to also meditation practice, because it is very, you have a very pure heart at this point. And then once you have that purity of heart, then the depth of wisdom becomes possible as a consequence. So, these four things, Vyagapajja, lead to a family man's welfare and happiness in the future life. Okay, so there you are, a little sutta about these things. And a very, the suttas are always interesting, regardless of how you almost approach them and whichever you read. And from here on, we can focus more on the development of the mind itself. Okay, that's all for now. I'll see you again this evening.